Reporting on politics and public policy is supported by the Center for Western Studies at Augustana University.
Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein speak at Augustana University's Bowe Forum, and Governor Noam signs capital carry and In God We Trust school displays into law. It's all fodder for the Dakota political junkies. Joining us this week, John Hunter. He is publisher of the Madison Daily Leader. Hi, John. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Thanks for asking.
Also with us, Roger Whittle. He is managing editor of the Watertown Public Opinion. Hey, Roger. Thanks for coming back again.
It's good to be back.
All right. There's so many things that we could begin with today, but John Hunter and I were at the Bowe Forum last night, kind of ran into each other. And Roger, I have to tell you, pretty much it was me just standing there while everybody came up and said hi to John Hunter. He's a he's something of a,
I believe that.
A celebrity. And like a true journalist, he had these little really impeccably meticulous notes all over the back of his program. So these are my observations of John Hunter in the wild. I've had a sighting.
John? Well, Lori, I have to turn the table on you, too, because you were critiquing a little bit of the interview. Say, hey, go back to the answer. You didn't answer that question.
Yeah, I was like, I got to get up there. They didn't answer that question. All right. So, John, what kind of notes did you take? What were some of the things, you know, for listeners who don't know, and I'm guessing everyone does, but Woodward and Bernstein were the Washington Post reporters assigned to cover the break-in at the Watergate Hotel, all of which eventually led to uncovering corruption in the White House and the resignation eventually and the pardon of President Richard Nixon at the time. They told that story and stories that I had never heard before and a lot more talked about the condition of American journalism right now. So, John Hunter, what's scribbled on the back of that program?
Well, there were a whole bunch of things, Lori. It was just an extraordinary evening, and I was a bit surprised right away that the two of them walked on stage. And remember, this their work as Watergate reporters was 45 years ago.
Yeah.
But they walked on the stage, and instantly it was a five-minute standing ovation from the entire Ellman Center crowd. People thought they were rock stars. I mean, that's more than Condoleezza Rice got last year. So I think people really do understand that kind of turning point in how journalism really exposed corruption in a good role that journalism played in that. Journalism has been under attack probably for the entire history of the United States, and certainly there are some parallels, I think, from what Nixon was trying to do to Woodward and Bernstein that are parallels today. You know, Nixon was trying to discredit the reporters. They'd call the Washington Post. They'd bar them. You know, Nixon banned the Washington Post from coming to the White House. You know, parallels with, you know, fake news about, you know, yelling that or enemy of the people and trying to discredit journalists. So, fortunately, in my opinion, journalism will stand the test of time and continue to do that. But, you asked on what kinds of things are scribbled on the back. There were a couple of them. Carl Bernstein really got philosophical for a second and said, you know what, best journalism, he called it, is the best obtainable version of the truth, which kind of implies that, you know, different people have a different viewpoint of what the truth is. So journalism is to try to find out what the best version of that is and obtainable. I mean, that some things are hidden forever. But if you can tell that truth, that's what journalism is about.
And one of the early things, Stephanie Herseth-Sandlin, president of Augustana University, conducted the interview. She did a really excellent job. And one of the first things she kind of kicked it off with was, you know, what put them in the position to get the kind of coverage and do the story that they did. And they said, you know, they were lucky enough to be metropolitan reporters. In other words, they were covering the local scene. And Roger, I'm wondering if now's not a good time to talk about local journalism in the sense that, you know, that sometimes, more often than not, really, the people who are uncovering corruption and dealing with, you know, water pollution and what's happening in City Hall are often the people who live in the community and are going to go knock on the doors.
That's a really good point. You got to remember, back in the early stages of Watergate, there were political reporters weren't touching this story on Watergate, and it was these two local guys who were doing all the work. And it wasn't until they were well on the way of uncovering everything that the rest of the nation jumped on board with it. So, yeah, it just shows you the importance of local journalism to our society. And I feel like it's a little bit under threat right now, and it's something we have to figure out how to save.
Mm. They also talked, and Roger, you weren't here for, you know, kind of the context of what they were saying, but they talked about a newspaper is a product, and we always have to be thinking about how to make that product more usable, how to make it better for the audience. How do you, I'm curious with Roger and John, how do you consistently make your newspapers viable and better versions of what a local newspaper should be? Roger, do you want to start there?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for rubbing it in that I was not able to go there last night. When I first heard they were going to be there, I was very excited and was planning on going, but circumstances didn't allow that, and I feel horrible about it. So it's kind of making me a little sad to hear you two talk about how great it was. But anyway, to get back,
that's what we're here for. We're here to help you out, Roger.
we're really in a time of transition in journalism, which is really a reflection on what's happening in the world. That people are going away from the traditional sources of news and entertainment. You know, people are not buying books as many as they used to. Now you can download ebooks. So journalism right now is kind of struggling with how to transition from that printed daily paper into a digital world. And I think we're making progress. We're certainly better now than we were 5 or 10 years ago. But it's going to take a while before we make that transition fully. We focus, video is one thing now that when I was a young journalist, if you would have told me that I owned a video camera and be actually shooting moving pictures of things and using them in my job as a newspaper person, I would have said, well, that's just ridiculous. How can you do that? But those are the kind of opportunities that we have now. And I think especially, older people like me are having to do some major rethinking of the way we do things to appeal to today's audience. And that's going to be a continuing process now for, I would think, another 10 years or so.
John, your thoughts on, having a print community paper that evolves and is valuable to its readers and gets new readers as they get old enough to, subscribe to their own newspaper. How do you sort of approach that in Madison?
Well, ultimately, content is what is going to drive journalism. So the people with the best content are going to win in one way or another. So the question is, there are costs to getting that content and to assigning reporters to thing and digging into so forth. So are people willing to pay a small amount of money to get that more information, or would you rather rely on things that are free from your friends through Facebook or whatever the alternative sources are? So I have a strong belief that people ultimately want the truth. And they'd say young readers, viewers, whatever we call people who are consuming news today, understand at least a little bit that the stuff that they see for free that might be off a Facebook or a Twitter kind of thing, they say young readers can recognize that may not be truthful, and that it depends a little bit upon the author and so on. So ultimately, I think people are going to want some source somewhere, whether it's online or in print or on TV or wherever that is, that they can trust and say, hey, when I really want to find out what's happening, I can go to this source of some port. So I think our job as journalists or as media is to try to provide something that people can rely on, that they can trust, and they say, yeah, they've gone through a process that ensures that what they're saying is the best obtainable version of the truth.
And and John, here we would call those people listeners, and we really Woodward and Bernstein didn't really talk about the power of radio or public radio at all. Obviously, I believe pretty strongly in that. I also believe in print and the written word. And I want to go back to something Roger said about, the introduction of video and digital content. Is it that we always need to sort of keep up and catch up with what's happening right now? Or in some way, good writing is always going to be good writing. Good reporting is always going to be good reporting. Excellent radio and audio storytelling stands by itself in some ways too. Roger, how do you balance sort of chasing after and being in tune with the latest ways of delivering great content and still focusing on, like, you know, we're a print newspaper and people still want to read a really smart local story that's accurate and fair and without error. And that takes time and that takes resources. And maybe we don't need the best video to go with it online. How do you balance sort of some of those decisions editorially?
Well, that is the question all newspapers are struggling with now. I believe, like you said, it is the substance of the story and the content of the story that is important. But today's audience doesn't receive that information in the same way that audiences did, you know, when I started in this business 35 years ago. Yes, the journalism is what matters, and I believe that the methods of delivering that information has to keep up with the changing technology that's available. Young kids today grow up, you know, getting all their information online, and I think it's going to be difficult to get those people, the teenagers now, the 20-somethings, to when they're in their 30s and productive members of society, if you will, to depend on a paper product every day. I think newspapers, yeah, there'll always be some people who prefer their news that way, but we have to cross platforms and again get the information out to the most people we can the best way we can. And I think in the future that's going to be digitally.
We could talk about journalism all day, and I'm sure we will in the future, but we should probably get to some of the other headlines in the state political scene. And also, I wanted to transition to something John Hunter wrote about the admissions scandal, the college admissions scandal. And you're in a college town, John, and of course, Lake Area Tech is in Watertown, a tech school. And we've had all kinds of conversations on this program about, you know, keeping kids in local colleges, you know, recruiting from out of the state, when to get a four-year degree, when to get a tech school degree. And John, give us an idea of how you sort of approach this college scandal from a South Dakota perspective.
Well, South Dakota has, as you know, a number of post-secondary choices for students. There are public universities, there are private nonprofit universities, there are private for-profit universities, tribal colleges. Some people call the Watertown and others technical colleges. So there's lots of choices, but none of those really are in the position that they have kind of an artificial cap on enrollment that would lend itself, I think, a little bit to scandals. And in fact, most of them would like to have more rather than trying to exclude, you know. I wrote that Yale has only a 6% acceptance rate. So other than all the people who apply to Yale, only 6% are admitted. So that has led these overly ambitious and parents to act illegally to try to get their students in. So in some cases, it's quite different in South Dakota than these exclusive universities elsewhere. Now, that's not to say there aren't really real challenges in admissions and the financial struggles of both institutions and of students, and, you know, the student debt that's being piled up and so on. There are going to be challenges in admissions, but you'd like to think that the best universities or technical schools or tribal colleges or whatever are going to try to act ethically in that, and that they will take extra steps to avoid scandals and so on, and make these schools and universities something we can be proud of.
And to be fair, the colleges, as far as I've seen so far, have all said, you know, we're the victims here. It's not widespread, but we're being dealt with as victims in this scandal, not as perpetrators. Go ahead.
No, Laurie, you bring up actually a good segue there. Remember, part of that, you know, we were talking about video and audio and relying on sources other than kind of trusted sources. Remember, part of this scandal was actually a photoshopping technique where they would take athletes and photoshop their own child's head onto someone who's rowing or playing soccer or something like this. So it's a kind of a modern-day manipulation of media that was part of this scandal, where they were saying, hey, my students, my son or daughter is a great athlete, and they get admitted to school, and then because of their athletic ability, and then they get there and they say, oh, I forgot I was injured, and so I'm just going to go to school. I've already been enrolled, so I'm here for good. But that's really kind of a manipulation. I mean, you know, if you see a photo of something really strange on a social media site, I think a lot of people would kind of question that, right? Like, oh, this is fake or this is manipulated or whatever. And that's exactly what happened in this admission scandal.
You said an artificial cap on enrollment and how South Dakota schools don't really have that. Do you think some of those major colleges, the elite colleges, if you will, are capping their enrollment artificially to create, you know, a desirability or competitiveness?
Absolutely.
Really?
I guarantee it.
It's not.
Yeah,
it doesn't have to do with the size of the college and the fact that they've been around,
right,
you know, for, you think it's just a fake cap?
Well,
artificial cap.
There is something to exclusivity that increases the appeal of anything. So if you say, hey, there's only 10 bottles of bleach left, you know, only 10 consumers are going to get this bottle of bleach, and all of a sudden people rush in and say, hey, we're out of bleach, that exclusivity somehow boosts its value rather than say, hey, you can have all the bleach you want. But if you say, look, there's only going to be 500 kids, maybe not that much, but
just sort of a weird comparison. It's a very specific comparison, John. Bleach.
Well,
go
you
ahead.
Work for a bleach company. That's the
oh, help. There it is. Okay.
But to say 500 students are going to get into Harvard or 1,000 or whatever the number is, and then you have 10,000 apply, yes, that exclusivity, rather than say, hey, let's just make Harvard that much bigger and admit everybody. Yes, that is part of that, and I don't see those things happening in South Dakota.
Right, Roger.
I would agree with that. I got two state colleges to admit me, so there obviously is not much exclusivity going on in this state.
Well, that's the big question, the underlying question, and it says in John's article that Dakota State University Associate Vice President of Enrollment Management is saying, you know, there, quote, there are certain academic benchmarks a new student has to meet in order to be admitted, and if they do, they're in. And so, and that's not the case at Harvard or Yale or Stanford. There are lots of kids who have those really high academic benchmarks who don't get in.
Absolutely.
Right, that's why.
Yeah, go ahead, Roger.
Well, I always said that, yeah, that's why kids today are just programmed that they have to apply to, you know, a half dozen colleges in order to get one acceptance. That wasn't the case when I went to school back in the 70s. You know, I applied to one school, and I got in according to my grades or ACT score or whatever it was. So, yeah, these problems that are happening nationwide, thank God, I don't think we're experiencing much here in South Dakota.
Mm-hmm. Let's transition to Governor Noem and some recent legislation she has signed, and this is the In God We Trust school display, the national motto, a requirement that the state legislature passed, that national motto must be displayed in public schools, and that if there are lawsuits, the state of South Dakota will bear the burden, the financial burden of those lawsuits. John Hunter, thoughts on In God We Trust?
Well, it's a little bit of a paradox, I think, for Republicans in this particular case. That kind of removal of God from public life, I think, wears on the party and would like to return that. I think that's what this is kind of about. On the other hand, it's been a long-time Republican platform for local control and local decision-making on this thing. So here's a case where they're not going to allow a school district to decide whether they should put that up or not. That is going to be a state mandate, and they will appropriate state funds to defend that kind of policy. So I think in one sense it's trying to reverse something that's been undone over the course of years. And second, I think they had to do something that they don't normally do to issue this edict to force schools to do this.
Roger, one of the things that I'm personally a little weary of is this whole notion of, are we going to get sued, and how do the potential lawsuits, you know, sort of fold into people's decisions about legislation? Do you think we're relying too much on the courts to sort of weigh in on some of these issues? Shouldn't the question be, you know, are we going to lose votes, or is this the right thing to do? You know, how should we have some of these conversations, Roger?
Well, that's a good question. I think most of our lawmakers obviously thought this was the right thing to do. And correct me if I'm wrong, I think the original bill was just was more of a suggestion that schools do this, and they amended it to make it mandatory.
It went back and forth, I think it started as mandatory, it went to allowed to, and it went back to mandatory is how I understand it. So a little back and forth between the House and Senate, yeah.
Right, and I think this the fact that they put a part of that bill in that the state would bear the financial burden of any lawsuits was a way to allow the legislatures to fully support this bill without having to take any responsibility for any consequences. Luckily, I don't believe the ALCU has come out steaming about this. I don't think they've indicated that they are going to sue over it, but it'll be interesting to see what happens.
So much more to talk about, but our time is short, so I'm going to say thank you to John Hunter, publisher of the Madison Daily Leader, and Roger Whittle, managing editor of the Watertown Public Opinion. Roger, thanks so much for being here.
Well, it was my pleasure.
John Hunter, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Lori.